Well, it's great to see you. I have acquired most of your books over the years and enjoyed them. And when I got the word from Atlantic that you were going to be in the area, I decided to come in on my day off
to talk to you. Well, so, that's...
I'm absolutely delighted to see you. And
you're going to have a big traffic jam getting home then this evening.
Well, fortunately, if I have to, I can walk. I'm only about 35 minutes.
So, God.
Not too bad. And I see, are you listening, Rabbi Lowe? Is it pronounced Lowe?
Mm-hmm.
He has those two funny little marks over the O there. I wasn't sure. You haven't lost your touch at all. Let's talk a little bit about you and your origins and your background and as we bring ourselves up to date. Because I know you were born in Brooklyn and raised in the Bronx, but of course... looking at you and seeing your pictures, you certainly look like a country Irish gentleman. Tell me a little bit about your background here in New York.
Well, I was briefly born in Brooklyn. And
briefly?
Then, that is to say, lived after my birth briefly in Brooklyn and moved almost directly to the Bronx. My parents lived in number 8 Willow Place in Brooklyn, which I believe is preserved by the city now. Not through anything connected with me, but just as an architectural kind of thing. It's this terrace of houses there in Willow Place, which is still intact. And they moved to the highest hill in the Bronx, where we lived for some years, and from there moved across the Bronx River to a little community called Woodlawn, a fascinating little community, which is cut off from New York by Woodlawn Cemetery on one side, Van Cortlandt Park on another, and the Bronx Park on the other. And so it's a time warp. I believe someone like Arthur Miller was driving into New York once, and they took the wrong turning and turned into this tiny little community of a few streets of these old houses and shaded trees and things, and wondered what on earth they'd hit. And then I discovered that papers like the New York Times would send reporters up there as a quick way of finding out what they people thought in Peoria instead of having the report come from there. And I had a little main street, Gatona Avenue, and literally was like a little Midwestern town. And that's where I grew up in the Bronx.
And you spent many happy hours in Woodlawn Cemetery.
Many. The only job I ever had in my life was there. I was cutting grass one summer in a school holiday. And so I was the worst grass cutter in the history of Woodlawn Cemetery. But I got to know all the mausoleums and the architecture, and it's a place that's eternally fascinated me. Once in Connecticut, I was reading a book about Herman Melville, and on the last page it said, Herman Melville on this rainy, chilly day was buried in Woodlawn Cemetery, and I could not believe it. And I'd actually worked near his grave, cutting the grass, never realizing that this is where Herman Melville had ended up. And I went to the cemetery. I was up in Connecticut reading the book at the time, returned to New York, went immediately to the cemetery, and I asked for Herman Melville's grave, thinking, you know, there'd be big signs pointing this way to Herman Melville's grave. No one had been to this grave, seen it, had anything to do with it. It took the woman a half an hour searching through old files to find out that they even had it there. And she finally came out with a map and said, oh, yes, there's Herman Melville's grave. And she drew arrows to where I could get to the grave. So that was a cemetery I lived by and near, which probably inspired, I suppose, a singular man to some degree, where George Smith builds this wonderful, massive mausoleum. And in fact, I did have plans to build this wonderful, massive mausoleum myself. And indeed, I think some newspapers did hear about this and did come there to find out whether this was in the process of being built.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my fascination with cemeteries must have come from that. And up before I moved to the house I presently own, I did own a cemetery. I had a cemetery on my land, and I'm now in the process of reestablishing a new cemetery where one hopes to be buried and maybe bury a few of my old pals who are deserving of that final resting place.
So you're a cemetery owner. This must have been a long-running graveyard, however, long before you got there.
Yes, this would have dated from the 9th century. Mm-hmm. It was had an old ruin of a 9th century chapel, and it was beautiful old yew tree. As you know, yew trees are highly poisonous to cattle. And generally, I didn't know whether they put the yew tree in the cemetery to make sure that people wouldn't let their cattle in to graze around the graves, because it would kill cattle immediately.
A yew tree is something like a Y tree.
That's right. They'd made bows out of them years ago. Robin Hood's bows would have been made from a yew tree. And the berries and the leaves and the actual fiber of the tree is highly poisonous.
Did you have a literary family as you grew up in Woodlawn?
Not really, no. I suppose I had overtones of that. My father actually started to write poetry at some late stage in his life, and indeed he's listed as one of the Longford authors. That's County Longford in Ireland. And but that was the only connection, and I think...
What did your father do?
He was a civil servant, worked in the fire department here in New York as a kind of building inspector, and he oversaw most of the kind of things that went on with explosives and things like that, and that's how I got my job in the cemetery. He oversaw the permits and things for the cemetery if they were building a big mausoleum and had to blow up rock formations to build it. And he owned property and things so that they were, reasonably, not affluent, but I suppose modestly comfortable.
Did you have literary pretensions? I think your original goal was to become a painter, wasn't it?
Yes, when I went to Ireland, I took up painting and started to give exhibitions and wrote forewords to the exhibitions. Then I think I started to give the exhibitions to write the forewords, and so this gravitation into writing occurred. And amazingly enough now, through some accidental thing, I have this great storehouse of pictures. Might have over 1,500 of them.
Your own pictures?
Yeah, which I'd collected over the years and would do drawings and things like that. Never took them seriously. And someone in Ireland actually came across this repository and asked me, would I like an exhibition again? And I had one about 2.5 years ago and have sold 200 pictures since. I'm having an exhibition in February. So I'm back in that trade. But I don't really psychologically have anything to do with it. I have my secretary and the person who's going to give the exhibition get together and put it on, and then I appear on the opening night. Because it's a very unpleasant world, the art world. Not like the literary world, which is far more pleasant.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. Have you ever thought about illustrating your books? There's a very fine writer here in America named Hugh Nissenson who does his own painting, and his paintings illustrate the book.
Well, amazingly, two of my books, I think, this book has illustrations in it, all done by me.
Oh.
Here's one. And there are some others. I don't know how illustrative that one is.
Certainly, yeah. I didn't realize you had done it.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. This is a very clever book, the one about... how to fart appropriately and this sort of thing. It took a certain degree of courage to write that, didn't it?
Well, amazingly, I felt it was the most important thing because it was inspired by crossing a New York street. And I don't know whether you instinctively do this when you cross the street, but if you know the people who are making the turn into the road and you're crossing the street and they stop, and I've watched cars get out of control in New York and plow ahead without warning. And so when I was crossing a street, I always found myself moving to the other side of the flow of pedestrian flow so that I'd be cushioned by 3 or 4 people if this event happened. And this was a kind of instinctual thing one just had crossing the street in New York. And so it did occur to me then, well, this is an unexpurgated situation. Being a very polite person, I hope, and, fairly courteous, I thought, well, is it discourteous to suddenly instinctively line up a cushion of other people to prevent the concussion hitting you directly and to be softened by that? And so that inspired my writing The Unexpurgated Code. And I thought, well, no one writes about the formalities to be adapted when you die or when you commit a social faux pas of releasing wind in various ways and so on. So this is how I set about it. But I'm about now writing another one which will never get published at all. And nobody wants to have anything, whatever they do with it. I mentioned it to my publisher, Carl Navarre, just in passing. And I could see his face sort of just, you know, go into a rather depressive countenance. And this book is called The Unexplicated Code of Growing Old. But I dare say it's possibly the funniest, you know, from my point of view, describing someone as one begins to feel the pangs of age. And it's got quite marvelous things that no one ever talks about, how you hire your nurse, how the most important things in life then become your assets. Clearly, that's what you're looked upon, because what's going to happen to you is you're about to be buried. So what, in fact, is left to identify you as someone that anybody else wants to talk to or have anything to do with? And it's your assets. And so, you know, this is what one is presently dealing with.
It'll find a home. You've been known to take risk before, and they've paid off. It'll find a home, I have
well,
no doubt.
I don't know whether they've paid off, but at least I've survived.
But after high school, what happened?
After high school, I joined the U.S. Navy, and that was the beginning of my writing career, amazingly. I went to the most astonishing school in the world. And the world has never known any place like it before or since, and it still exists. And it's called the Naval Academy Preparatory School. And no one has ever heard of this, have you?
No.
Well, it exists, still in operation. And I attended this school, and what happened was I was in the amphibious corps, off to the beach fighting amphibians. We sail at break of day. Well, all these boats that would go off to the beaches, every one of them were blown up. I mean, nobody was coming back alive out of these things. And I was patriotic enough, but I had a principle I felt very strongly about, is that I didn't mind dying as an admiral, but I certainly resented dying as a second-class seaman in the service of one's country. So I applied to take the exams for the Naval Academy and got an appointment to the Naval Academy. But before you headed off there, you went to this marvelous school for a year to prepare you to sit for the exams, a very democratic place. And it was in this school that I found myself. The Navy was in a position to recruit the most brilliant brains from the Navy to act as professors in the school. They had the most beautiful school in America, an old boys' school called the Tome School for Boys, a wonderful prep school on the Susquehanna River, the most idyllic, beautiful circumstances. So one was deposited in this place, wonderful erudite professors, and the most brilliant set of intellectuals in the classroom. People who were so fantastic when calculus questions were written on the board, which would take, you know, 5 minutes to write out. The men would get to the end of the thing waiting to set this for the class to take a half hour to figure out the answer. And before he put the last dot, as he put the last dot on the question, someone would shout out the answer, some genius in the back of the classroom. Well, at any rate, the point of this was that this school had this wonderful English professor, and these people were hated anything to do with writing or English. They knew I could write a few words and put them together, so I'd be assigned by about approached by about five or six people to write their themes for them. So I spent my time at the school writing everybody's theme, but I would have to do it in a style which was appropriate to them as people, if they were from Brooklyn or California or whatever. And so this professor said, well, we've got a ghost writer in this class. He could recognize somehow the style. And this was my first recognition as an author. So I started out in the Navy.
Ah, was it also your first writing for pay?
Well, I wasn't paid at all. I don't know how people compensated me then. I think it may have been from other favors that would occur. But from there, it was off to Europe, and I suppose I started fooling around with the painting situation and writing my forewords to exhibitions.
Your intention was to study at Trinity, wasn't it, in Dublin?
That's right, and I was reading what was termed Honours Natural Science, and I read zoology and bacteriology.
Zoology?
And bacteriology.
Study that stuff now, will you?
Well, medicine was always something that interested me, so I still to this day am fascinated by, you know, anything. I read more medical journals than I would anything to do with, say, even literary matters.
But you went on to London from Dublin, didn't you?
Yes, I came back to America for a year when I was writing The Ginger Man, couldn't find a publisher for it here, and then was living on the Isle of Man briefly, and then from there went to London, where I completed The Ginger Man in London, and thus started all my troubles as an author when the book was finally published by the Olympia Press Paris.
That's a wonderful story, and maybe you could give us an update. You had a difficult time finding a publisher, but Olympia was known as kind of an avant-garde publishing house. But you weren't very happy with what they did. Tell me about that.
Well, basically, they were a pornographic house, and what would happen with the Olympia Press in Paris is that Maurice Chérodias, who owned and ran the firm at the time, he had his list of pornographic books, but he did actually publish works of genuine authors, Henry Miller, Samuel Beckett, Jean Genet, wonderful writers. And their works did come out and were frequently just published as they were. Jean Genet, Lady of the Flowers, and there it was, a book just like this, man's name on it. What I got was, with The Ginger Man, was a volume in the Traveler's Companion series, and in the back of it, the list of the 1 to 12 numbered books, and these were all pornographic books. And The Ginger Man was stuck in this list of pornographic books in the Traveler's Companion series. This was the beginning of disaster. I can remember that day I got the book, having spent 3-4 years writing The Ginger Man, of practically breaking the book in half when my fist hit it, and I just remember swearing that I would revenge what had happened to that work, because it meant I entered obscurity, entered, you know, a pseudonymous, that I was just another pseudonymous author, J.P. Donlevy, and I had no literary reputation, there was no way of getting the book recognized, and so it was total disaster. And thus, from that moment, began a litigation between myself and the Olympia Press. And I realized I had to get the book out and had to get it published, had to get it recognized. Found a publisher in London who brought it out, and they published it there, and it did get recognition then.
Who was the publisher?
A publisher called Neville Spearman. And that then ensued this gigantic litigation, which went on then for 25 years in three countries. I did nothing but take a plane from one city to another and get off the plane, go into a courtroom. I employed 14 lawyers at a clip around the world.
It became an obsession. Years.
Well, it became a defense. The Ginger Man began to turn into an enormous pot of gold. As the years passed, this pot got bigger and bigger, and we were just throwing dice in courtrooms to see who'd win this. And it was a standoff, and I became pretty, as most writers are, they're all brilliant at litigation. It's a sort of natural for an author once he gets obsessed by it. And so I became an astonishing I'll quote Maurice Chérodias, who was interviewed a couple of years ago about this. He said, "You may wonder why J.P. Donlevy never turned out to be the great writer he might have been after writing The Ginger Man. And the reason is that he was too busy in litigation with me over all these years. You may have some doubt about J.P. Donlevy as a writer, but have no doubt about him as far as litigation concerned, he is a wizard out of this world." And of course, this was a compliment from the man who was one of the most brilliant litigators I've ever come across.
But did Olympia continue to hold publishing rights, even though The Ginger Man had been published in London and in New York?
That's right, and they were disputed, and there was a technicality just concerning with copyright, and I suppose everyone should know this, that you can only assign copyright under the written signature of the proprietor. And it was that technicality, because we had a long exchange of letters and no contract, And the contract then consisted of this long exchange of letters. And it was one of the reasons why we could dispute this. It was one of the reasons why I could proceed and get the book published in all these countries. And so I got, which is the opposite of what happens in publishing relationships, I got all the money and held on to it. And he used to scream over all the years that I was using the money to hire the lawyers to battle him. And so this giant confrontation took place over all those years. And the upshot being is that I finally ended up owning, as I do now, the Olympia Press, the only example of an author owning his original publisher.
So you wound up, and I guess you actually brought Olympia to bankruptcy, didn't you?
No, I think it happened possibly because there was a lot of trouble with all his writers. And over the years, I would get letters from a lot of these writers asking, you're able to deal with the Olympia Press, and I'm having this problem with them, and so on. Can you tell me what to do? Normally, I couldn't, because he was pretty brilliant at how he handled matters to do with it. And so I more or less had to stay out of it. I would help writers always if I could with advice, and still do. And so I think the Olympia Press, through one thing or another and troubles that created here in this country, and I think basically what happened to the Olympia Press was that the publisher made one mistake, and it was this, that obviously, all the writers who wrote the pornography were all quite well treated, but that was the relationship, a pornographic writer, and normally they didn't want to have their names on their works and would use pseudonyms. The mistake that was made was that he forgot that people who have the courage to sign their names on their work will fight anybody for it. And that was the thing. Probably all of these matters could have been settled in negotiation. But writers, some of them, become infuriated. And people like, I suppose, Vladimir Nabokov. Lolita was published at the same time as The Ginger Man. And I think they had a falling out over matters. And there were fallings out, never, as far as I knew, with any writer who had written a pornographic book. But trouble seemed to come from those writers who were genuine, straightforward writers.
So you're the proprietor currently of the Olympia Press, but you actually have a staff. I mean, you don't actually run it yourself, do you?
Well, it doesn't operate. It owns 258 dirty books, the copyrights.
Does that include The Ginger Man?
Well, I've taken The Ginger Man out of that company, and I know.
It's still publishing, though, isn't it? Olympia is still publishing.
Not really, no.
What's the backlist that you have?
It's the backlist. Yeah. I suppose one could reactivate it or give it to someone to reactivate, because there's now the phenomenon of antique pornography, which is quite interesting, and I believe people do buy antique pornography now.
Well, I was delighted with the Olympia Press back in the 50s, early 60s when I was young, because the only sex manual I had growing up was National Geographic. So Olympia was really an advance over National Geographic. Well, let's go back to The Ginger Man. This book has been, it's in print now. Atlantic Monthly has just put out a new edition of it. It's been around for years. It's hailed as a comic masterpiece. It's a hilarious book. And while it's a controversial book in many respects, some people said it was pornographic, it's certainly less raunchy than Are You Listening, Rabbi Lowe. Tell me how you got the idea for The Ginger Man, how this came about.
It came about at a time when we were, I think, Americans who had attended Trinity College Dublin were thinking towards the ending of our years there. They were all heading off to other parts of the world and leaving Ireland. And I think it was at that crucial time that one realized that the life we'd known and lived there was coming to an end and was over. And I remember being quite affected by this in a way. And I had a friend called Gaynor Stephen Crist, who was a contemporary of mine at Trinity, and an elegant gentleman from the Midwest. And his life was one of very polite existence, but he simply, things didn't work out in terms of he should have inherited a large fortune and pursued comfortable habits for the rest of his life, but his father disinherited him. And this mesmerized me for some reason, and I think that was the seed that planted the Dangerfield character. and he ran up debts. My life at Trinity in Dublin was luxurious. I had loads of money and probably have never lived as well since. His life, though, was beset by terrible things. I was astonished at the fact that he, one of the first things he thought of doing in Dublin was having a family photographic portrait taken of himself, his wife, and his child. That dumbfounded me to spend £10 to a photographer, when in fact I would have gone out and bought a bag of potatoes to live on for 3 months. But that was what fascinated me, that he went out and had the photographic portrait taken of his family and his child. And so it was that juxtaposition of the American who goes to Europe, finding Europe as, he was quoting him, as a double-edged sword. An American could find himself in the upper classes. There was no problem of entering the upper classes in England. It was a wonderful plaything. You could come from any sort of background in America. Mine was sort of middle class. His was sort of the slightly Brahmin class. And you could go to Europe and you could spend your time in the roughest parts of Dublin with the working class people who would accept you as one of themselves, or in a great country house having dinner in great elegance. And so in America, that was the other thing that fascinated me, an American to go to Europe. And once an American here that I'd known at the time, he settled in Canada, gave me his impressions of Americans then. And I was fascinated to hear this. It was only a couple of months ago. He said they were like spacemen from outer space, the most powerful figures in the world, because America had won this war, this world war. And these people came. And he told me that he used to follow me through the streets. He used to see what I wore on my feet, my jackets, everything I had. He said it was just unbelievable to watch these all-powerful Americans. And, of course, Americans were unconscious of this. They were handing out chewing gum and things of that nature. But they were unconscious of the fact that they were the most powerful people in the world. And there were a few Americans in Ireland then, so they were full of fascination for the resident population.
You better believe we're powerful. We're the people who conquered Grenada. Well, but one of the things that that set the Ginger Man apart was the interesting writing style, the explicit use of language. So it was really experimental for the day, wasn't it, in many respects?
Well, it would have overtones, say, of Henry Miller, who would have been an influence, Joyce, and so on. And certainly, because I first made my reputation as a painter, I did have an enormous advantage from the fact that I'd already achieved a fame not hard to do in Dublin, a small place like Dublin. But I did have that sense of being a sort of center of some attention. And as a writer, somehow I was able to sit down and work and use the language in a manner which I thought was the most efficient, and as a scientist, as it were. And I think that basically was why I experimented quite a bit. It took about 100 pages or so when the style began to find itself in writing The Ginger Man. I notice now, if you pick up The Ginger Man, you'll see question marks, which I've never used in any subsequent book. And, that's just an added kind of efficiency, because I use the language to ask the question and keep that. So I try to make the language in its use get to the reader's mind in the most direct possible way, basically.
Did you run across any censorship problems with The Ginger Man?
Yes, it went through all kinds of censorships everywhere it arrived in those days. There was an order for its destruction in Manchester. I remember being interviewed with Ian Fleming, whose work the Bond books was being thought as being pornographic. And quite the opposite to what one would expect, the more literate people in television then were looking upon me as a genuine, serious writer whose work was accused of being pornographic, and here was James Bond's work, or Ian Fleming's work, being looked upon, regarded as possibly pornographic, and big best-selling books and so on. So the Ginger Man received constant. It was turned down by 45 publishers before it found the Olympia Press. And even after it was published by the Olympia Press, it was turned down by dozens of publishers here in New York. And it was only by accident. John Osborne was being interviewed in the New York Times about being an angry young man here. And he said, that's a misnomer because someone who's regarded as an angry young man is not even English. He's an American who wrote a book called The Ginger Man. And that little thing in the New York Times was the thing that got The Ginger Man published in America. No one would publish the book.
So the book grew. It was not an overnight success, was it?
Took years and years. And it finally hit some sort of position. I remember the exact day I was in London in this production office in the West End, and one of the guys in this office came in who was directing my place and said, "Holy Christ, have you seen what's happened?" I said, "No, what's happened?" He said, "The Ginger Man." I said, "What? What about the Ginger Man?" He said, "It is all over London." Now, you would imagine that that meant, you know, a book had been published and was out in bookstores and people would see it. And I said, "Well, it's all over London." I said, "Where? You know, is it in Hatchard's bookstore?" He said, "No. Jesus," he said, "go down in the street." And down in the street, every newsstand had stacks of The Ginger Man next to the newspapers. It was selling on the newsstands. No book had, I think, had ever before or since done that. And for months afterwards, walking around London, you constantly saw people walking around carrying the book. I've never seen this happen since. But that's it. When it hit, finally. And this was the Corgi edition of The Ginger Man.
I'm sorry, the Corgi?
Corgi.
What was
it? It was a paperback house in London.
I see.
And so they brought out the first unexpurgated copy in Britain of The Ginger Man. And so they obviously put it out in that manner. So, and the book had been known and already sort of got word of mouth.
Wait a minute, what were the expurgated versions? What was expurgated?
The first expurgated version was published by Neville Spearman, and that came out in London. Then there was an expurgated version published by McDowell Obolensky here in New York about 1958 in hardcover. Then after that, there may have been an expurgated version brought out by Berkeley Books paperback. Then the first unexpurgated edition came out in paperback by Corgi in Britain. But the first unexpurgated hardcover perfect edition was published by Seymour Lawrence Delacorte Press, who brought it out then in 1965. And that was the first time that it had come out in America, the first unexpurgated edition.
Well, what did they take out for the expurgated edition?
I remember in the case of Neville Spearman, they said, "Look, could you let us just take out certain things we feel that they could suppress the book for, and in return we will undertake to pay all the legal costs if they do sue." And since I had the book out in unexpurgated form already and available in Paris, I agreed with this agreement. But then when the book was published in America, they picked up on the same basis for proceeding with the book here. And it wasn't until 1965 with the hardcover that it came out unexpurgated, and then in London in about 1961. And then I think it's now gone into its 86th printing. I think that might be the 86th printing that I've counted up.
Oh, it's a wonderful story, about this book. Somehow, along the line, you left London, you wound up in Ireland, where you made your home now for many, many years. How did you land there?
Well, that happened very simply. One day, walking to my wine merchants in Fortnum and Mason in London, he said, "Mr. Donlevy, what are you doing here?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you're still here." And I said, "Yes, I've come for tea as I do every day." And he said, "Well, why aren't you in Ireland?" I said, "Why should I be?" And he said, "Well, they've made authors tax-free." I said, "How do you know that?" He said, "I've just read it in The Economist magazine." I said, "Well, I'll get a copy around the corner." I got a copy around the corner, and not long after, got into my car and found myself racing down the highway towards Ireland.
How did you get that car across the water?
Yes, I had to take the ferry across the water as well.
They actually give you tax breaks there. That's probably the only country that does that for a full-time writer, huh?
Yes, it's more than a tax break. You literally just don't pay any taxes on your earnings from your writings. And in my case, I'd always adhered to this principle. I don't make money out of any other thing, and I've always done this. I don't invest money. I don't try to make money in any other way. And I've always done that as a writer. So it suits me tremendously, because still my income is totally from authorship. I am a cattle breeder, but I find that may be costing me money rather than making money. So I still think this principle obtains. So the Irish tax thing suited me marvelously.
I was talking to Richard Condon a while ago. Did you ever run across him in Ireland when he lived there?
I haven't done, but I think in Richard Condon's case, he was paying all his taxes in America, and he simply liked Ireland. I'm afraid that he may have been in Ireland for purist reasons as a lover of Ireland.
Well, he didn't like it too much after a while. It got very lonely. He said about the once a week, the Guinness Stout Man would come around, but that was about it. So he packed off and went to Dallas, of all places.
He's living in Dallas. Yes, that's quite unbelievable. I don't understand.
His daughter lives there, that's why.
I see.
You began writing books. Your new book, of course, Are You Listening, Rabbi Lowe, is a sequel to Schultz. Tell me about Schultz and the new book and how they relate.
Well, Schultz, I think it's happened to me now with one or two books that as I'm writing notes on a work that one's doing, I find the notes accumulate enormously. And one thing that gets surprising is that you find that you somehow don't often use these notes. There are hundreds of incidents, overtones, conversations, and things that accumulate. And as you're writing the book, it's only occasionally that you sort of go back and use notes. And you find that you're actually accumulating a second book. And that seems to be happening with things I write. And The Destinies of Darcy Dance, a Gentleman, now has two volumes. And I'm presently writing the third volume, hoping that my accumulated notes don't produce a fourth. But this is what happened with Schultz, that I found myself in writing Schultz, that hundreds of little incidents and things would crop up, which I'd make a note of. And then finally you get to the end of the book, having written the first volume, and you suddenly are confronted that there's a whole new and another volume to write.
Schultz comes from a long family of rabbis. Tell me a little bit about this character.
Well, this had a lot to do with sort of Czechoslovakia, which I took to visiting occasionally in Prague, and the old Jewish cemetery in Prague. And Rabbi Lowe is buried there, and is one of these people to whom the Jewish folk, when they come and visit the cemetery, they go to him to look for sort of psychological advice, or at least to have their wishes met. If they write out their wishes on a piece of paper and fold it up and throw it into the grave, these are supposed to be answered by Rabbi Lowe. And that intrigued me, and I think this is how Schultz took on this character of always responding to Rabbi Lowe when he needed advice.
Of course, in the new book, everything goes badly for Schultz. Anything that can go wrong does go wrong for him. But after the book was published here, you ruffled a lot of feathers. There was some contention that your character was actually anti-Semitic and that you had embarrassed females. How do you answer this kind of criticism?
Yes, admittedly, I think that one felt one might be embarrassing the female contingent in America. Amazingly, I was certainly having a lot of very difficult reactions to Rabbi Lowe in terms of publishing, and it's interesting that my publisher, Carl Navarre, is in fact a man, a very sophisticated gentleman, and who, you know, was totally unruffled by the subject matter of Rabbi Lowe. But there's no doubt at all that in the kind of not particularly Jewish female world, but in the feminist world, that the outcry is massive. As Sergei here, who was present down in Florida with me, we had a lady sort of screaming out, "You sexist bastard." So I am conscious of these attacks, but usually I'm never attacked by ladies over the age of 35 at all. They sit down and quite enjoy the book.
Lucky. Lucky you. What about the anti-Semitic elements, the stereotypical Jewish theatrical producer, for example? This is the kind of thing that has also irritated people.
Yes, now that's fascinating to me. It only reflects, I suppose, the accuracy with which one tried to create, firstly, the whole... the Jewish influence in using the language. I don't know whether you've ever listened to it, but it's a fascinating, wonderful way of, "You schlemiel, don't call me a schlemiel, you bump." You know, it's a very pointed and with a slightly, the words ending strongly, sort of an up kind of, and the use of language in that way. And so I had to make Schultz use this language in this Jewish vernacular. And this is what I attempt to do. And if that's anti-Semitic, then one can't help this. But as I have explained several times now, that I have long suffered from anti-Semitism myself, because with great frequency, and as you mentioned when we first came into your studio here, that you know, authors have a very low profile in the United States, and that anything to do with books is shoved in some closet or kicked in the face. But so in my case, if someone, I was introduced to somebody, they wouldn't know who the hell I was. J.P. Donlevy, what's that? So someone would say, "Oh, meet Mr. Donlevy." And that means Mr. Donald Levy. So I have gone through my life as Mr. Donald Levy everywhere. So I'm, in fact, may even look Jewish. I've sometimes worn a yarmulke. I had to going to see a Jewish cemetery in Vienna, I remember. But no one ever questioned the fact that I wasn't Jewish. You know, it's, so this has fitted me tremendously well, and so I've lived my life as a Jew, suffering anti-Semitism on all sides. So I think quoting out of The Ginger Man is a wonderful thing about anti-Semitism, because the Irish do have this tendency to be anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-everything. The Irish have this built in them somewhere, where Kenneth O'Keefe is walking through the streets of Dublin, and these boys, because they look curious and strange, point fingers at them and say, "Jews, Jews." And O'Keefe swings around and points his finger at them and says, "Irish, Irish." And these kids don't know what to make of that. They suddenly shrink away. And so this anti-Semitism or anti-Irish thing, I could describe myself as anti-everything, you know, anti-American, anti-British, anti-this and anti-that. No, my business as an author is not to worry about that, and clearly that could have been something that might have held one's hand back from truly describing the Jewish world and how they do business and show business. And a lot of them are very elegant and sophisticated. It just so happens that Schultz would revert to this kind of some of the deals, like what's he called, the big New York producer doing with Schultz. And I've heard these conversations, I've sat in them, I've had people, you know, these references come back and forth, you know, "Give me numbers. Hey, what do you mean by this deal? Don't, I'm not going to put my neck in a mangle for you." You know, this is going on, and this is all couched as these deals are being consummated. you know, what do you think, you're crazy, what do you think, you know, that sort of stuff.
Well, J.P. Donnelly, we were almost out of time, but just to kind of wrap things up, a question or two about your current life in Ireland. You are currently an Irish citizen, is that right?
That's right.
Does that mean you lose your American citizenship?
Yes, effectively. And I became an Irish national in 1967.
I can understand the reasons for settling there, but why did you wish to become an Irish citizen rather than to retain your American citizenship?
For international tax purposes, there was a period where I had seven different residences, Switzerland, London, three places in London, a place in the Isle of Man, a place in New York, all over. And with the tax man, when I'd start to talk to him, it just got so chaotic. I said, look, someone said, become an Irish citizen and let's locate you here and, you know, take care of these tax complications.
You still have all that property?
No, I have just one big, enormous property now, which makes up for the loss of all these six others.
The ginger man has been good to you.
It's probably saved my life, and does so nearly on every street corner to this day.
Now, you say you raise cattle, so you have this enormous ranch? You call it a ranch in Ireland?
Ireland, the land is very rich. I have a couple of hundred acres, but 1 acre of Irish land is equivalent to, you know, nearly 100 acres in Texas, probably, because of the fertility of Irish soil. But I raised a few horses and have a cattle herd, breeding cattle.
Isn't that distracting from your writing?
It's supposed to be relaxing. What you're supposed to do is look out the window and look at the beauty of the cattle grazing along, and it's a very nice sound if you walk among your cattle to hear them tearing the grass, knowing that each little tear means another little penny racked up, and that's supposed to make you calm. But often you'll walk out and find out they've broken through the fences and they're out on the highways and you're being sued by 50 people. You know, it can be terrible, too.
What's it like coming back to the United States after so long a residence in Ireland?
I come as an alien, slightly terrified, wondering if I might break my arm, heavily, heavily medically insured, and wondering, you know, when the next plane leaves. But I come then and get here and spend a few minutes in America and realize it's the most fascinating place in the world, where literature and novels are around the corner in 5 minutes. The language, everything that happens here is grist for an author's mill.
Well, J.P. Donnelly, you certainly are a literary treasure, and it's wonderful having the chance to talk to you for this past hour. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.